Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, July 28th. Uncharted territory, an East Honolulu City Council race just got dealt a curveball, and the primary election is just 2 weeks away, and a court has ruled incumbent Tommy Waters can't run again. We hear what the ruling may mean for the other candidates in the race and for a city council that stands to lose its chair. We look into the fallout over the bribery indictments handed down late Friday afternoon, and we have golf on our mind. We survey the landscape and the need for a golf strategy. Plus, a new law raises the minimum age for riding in truck beds. We consider the practice. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Circuit Court Judge James Ashford dealt City Council Chair Tommy Waters a blow with the ruling that the East Honolulu lawmaker isn't eligible to run again. But the election deadline is just days away, and some voters have already sent in their ballots. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Ben Angarone joins us. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good. And you were in the room where it happened yesterday, down at the courthouse. That must have been a real shocker for Tommy Waters.
It definitely was. Yeah, to put you kind of in the shoes, it was us from Civil Beat, me and a photographer, and then two people from Hawaii News Now, and then a kind of full courtroom where Tommy had a bunch of lawyers on his side, and Trevor Ozawa, representing himself, was kind of alone at his own little table. And this ruling came at the end of approximately an hour-long kind of hearing, and so I think a lot of people were surprised by the ruling. You know, I had done a story last month, and some election law people I talked to had said that charters kind of ambiguous, and the judge in that case might side with keeping the candidate on, and so I didn't really know how it was going to play out, but it became clear when the judge started talking about his ruling on this, and he said a few other kind of more manini rulings related to, you know, Trevor Ozawa does have the standing to even bring this up in the first place, because that was something Tommy Waters' team was trying to question. But then at the very end of that, he said, all right, and now what we're all here for. And it became clear to me very quickly that he was going to side with Trevor Ozawa. And the argument that he made ended up being pretty simple. Judge Ashford said the city charter describes two types of terms a council member can have, a vacancy term and a regular term. And this was not a vacancy term, and therefore it was a regular term, and therefore it counts towards the term limits. And I think as he was speaking, I was kind of looking around the room like, oh my God, oh my God. It was a kind of somber mood on the Tommy Waters side, as you might imagine.
Oh, yes, because, you know, people have already marked up their ballots. They've sent it in. Lots of questions. But yeah, it boiled down to that, that definition, you know. So they both gambled, and in Tommy Waters' case, it looks like he's lost. But he indicated that he might appeal this ruling.
Yeah, he plans to appeal this. And so when I talked to him right afterwards, he said he wanted to talk to his lawyers first. He's now said that he plans to appeal this. And so we have probably a chaotic few months coming up. It is unclear exactly how this is going to go. As you mentioned, ballots have already gone out. Ballots have already been submitted. Not all of them, but a good portion of them. We roughly estimated that yesterday about 65,000 ballots had been sent out to voters in the Council District 4 region, and roughly 8,000 or so have been submitted. And so that's a lot of votes that may or may not count for Tommy. It is unclear what's going to happen there. I talked to Scott Nago, who is the chief elections officer for the state of Hawaii, yesterday. He said that for him, it kind of comes down to what does the city clerk decide? Will the city clerk decide to count Tommy's votes? Will the city clerk decide not to count Tommy's votes? There's a lot of ways this could go legally, and we have not yet seen We are yet to see how that will all actually shake out.
Yes, and the city clerk, he's in an acting position, right? Chad Kudota.
Correct, yes. So Chad Kudota took on this role around March, April-ish, and so he's relatively new to the job. When I talked to him last month and I brought up this concern for a story about Tommy Waters' third term attempt, Chad Kudota, this acting clerk, he even said that he's not exactly sure what the answer is about whether Tommy is eligible or not. Since then, he's issued a preliminary ruling saying he thinks that Tommy Waters is eligible, but it does come down now kind of to how he wants to handle all of the ballots that have come in so far. And for context also, the city clerk reports to the Honolulu City Council, and Tommy Waters chairs the Honolulu City Council.
Yes, yeah, it's an awkward spot to be in, I think,
yes,
with this ruling. But
yep.
I just think, you know, if you voted and you want to know if your vote's going to count, you know, I mean, that's an interesting question. So really in uncharted territory here.
Yep. Yep. It is an interesting week politically for the state of Hawaii.
Yeah. And, you know, I know we've got to get past the primary to get to the general. But, yeah, lots of unanswered questions that, you know, we hope will become clear because, you know, primary day is just days away.
Yep. And Tommy is campaigning as if he expects that the ruling will go his way. I talked to a friend yesterday who said that after he was somber at the courthouse, she saw him later that evening sign waving around Kahala Mall area. So Tommy's digging in. He's filing this appeal and he's digging in.
Yes, and I did see Trevor out there sign waving as well. So an interesting rematch. But thanks so much.
Yep, and they've got two other opponents. So definitely an active race.
Okay. Yep. We've been talking to Honolulu Civil Beat's Ben Angarone. He's been reporting on Tommy Waters' ineligibility to run for re-election. You can read the full story at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, committed to helping meet Hawaii's clean energy goals and developing opportunities for fuel decarbonization. Learn more at hawaiigas.com.
All right, here's a business suggestion. Insurance for artificial intelligence.
Just like a human might mess up, AI might mess up even worse, or it might say things that it shouldn't say. It might calculate things it shouldn't calculate.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, paying the price for chatbot blunders next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6 o'clock. Support for HPR comes from the Maui County Elections Division. Ballots can be mailed using the supplied envelope or dropped off at official ballot drop boxes. Locations at mauicountyvotes.gov.
HPR also reached out to longtime political analyst and University of Hawaii political scientist Professor Cullen Moore to talk about the circuit court ruling. Moore spoke with HPR's Mark Liddell about the unexpected ruling and what comes next.
In some ways, this will become as much an election administration case and issue as much as it's now been a term limits case. I think the important thing to emphasize, though, is that anyone who has cast a ballot already and lives in this district, none of the other races they voted in, I mean, nothing will change as a result of this for that. So if there's a concern that somehow a ballot would be invalidated, that won't happen. So this doesn't invalidate ballots that have already been cast. Depending on the ultimate outcome here, there may be a question and a decision made about what a vote for Waters ultimately means after the election, if indeed he ultimately is judged to not be eligible to run, and that's something that we'll have more clarity about relatively soon. But to go back to the point I was making previously, because voting is already underway, the courts will be under considerable pressure to resolve this very quickly and give election officials clear instructions. And, you know, a disqualified candidate, ballots cast for that candidate are generally still counted. And then, you know, the question will be how those votes are counted in the end. And there are a variety of ways this is been addressed in the past. But, you know, I guess, you know, about the ultimate result here, this was a surprising decision, although I think a reasonable one. And the Waters campaign will appeal. And I think the courts will work quite quickly to resolve that appeal. And then we'll know a lot more, you know, about what next steps to take. But for anyone who's already cast a ballot and lives in this district, the other contests they voted for will not be affected by this at all.
My assumption would be that the favorite to win, assuming that Waters is eligible, would be him. I mean, way more fundraising, way more support. He is the incumbent.
Correct. I mean, yeah. So going back to that, I mean, if the appeal is granted and he's allowed to remain on the ballot, then he certainly is the odds-on favorite to win the election. I mean, that's what everyone expected prior to this decision. And, you know, I would continue to believe that that would be true if the appeal is granted. And so, you know, that's going to be the question. But if it's not, then there's a range of possibilities, I suppose.
I know you had mentioned it, but like for voters, how much of this do they have to, I guess, be concerned with? Other than like maybe Tommy Waters isn't on the...
Well, you're right. This is why this so rarely happens. This is why courts are reluctant to intervene when there's an election underway, because it creates chaos and tremendous confusion among voters. I mean, do voters assume that Waters' appeal will ultimately be granted and vote as normal? Do they assume that it will not and vote for somebody else? That's the reason the courts are going to work so quickly, because this kind of uncertainty is a terrible thing to have when an election is ongoing. That's almost why I don't even want to speculate about potential scenarios until we know for sure what's going on, because I think that just will confuse people even more. I mean, so if the appeal is granted, then nothing changes. Everything counts as normal. Waters remains on the ballot. But, you know, a lot of this will depend on the ruling on the appeal. And at this point, it's unclear. It's unclear to me what the appeal decision will be. And you know, that means it's going to be unclear to voters whether or not Waters remains on the ballot or not. And that affects their decision to, you know, whether to support him or somebody else or change their vote or continue with the vote they plan to make. This is why situations like this are often avoided at all costs, because it does exactly what you don't want during an election, which is to create confusion among voters who are participating in the election. But, you know, that's not to say the judge shouldn't have ruled as he ruled. I mean, this is happening at a very awkward time, and the appeal will happen at a very awkward time as an election is ongoing. And there's no remedy for that except to hope that the courts work very, very quickly and ultimately coming to a full resolution.
I can see, regardless of what the outcome of the appeal, that this is probably not good for Tommy Waters.
We can say that. That is fair. This is not good for Tommy Waters. And I think it's not something that most people who are following this thought would happen. It's certainly very good for Trevor Ozawa. You know, and either way, even if Waters ultimately remains on the ballot and wins his appeal, this muddies the water and it will create confusion among his supporters. And that's not good for his election chances either. So that's certainly a fair statement that Tommy Waters was the loser of this today. And, you know, even if the appeal is granted, this has created a major problem for his campaign.
There's already a ruling. We still have to think about the appeal. But if the appeal, or I mean, if the ruling stands, if Tommy Waters' appeal isn't granted, how does it change the race?
I mean, at this point, Trevor Ozawa is the only other well-known candidate who has the campaign apparatus to you know, to connect with voters in a major way. And so I think if Waters remains disqualified, I would expect Trevor Ozawa to ultimately win. He is a former member of the council and is well known and has been campaigning. And, you know, I think it was widely expected that when Waters was still in the race that, you know, he would be the second place candidate. So if Waters is disqualified, I think that Ozawa has a very good chance at winning this, but it doesn't mean he would win in this first round. I mean, it would likely move to the general election, which would give the other candidates time to campaign and maybe enhance their campaigns from people who now realize that there's, you know, that they're going to be one of the major candidates moving on in November. So, you know, that's another question mark. So I don't think you can say that, you know, automatically Ozawa wins, but, you know, he would certainly be moved from being someone who was not expected to win to, you know, to the candidate who would certainly be the favorite.
And then maybe going forward, I don't know how much you want to go into the makeup of the city council without a Tommy Waters. If there was some expectation that he was going to be chair again or elected again.
It's a great question. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that Waters was expected to remain chair and be the dominant force on the council that he has been. He ran an aggressive campaign highlighting his accomplishments, and this would be a major change for the council. I mean, they would have lost their most powerful member, who nearly everyone thought was going to win re-election. And so, yeah, of course, that would shake up the council pretty seriously. And, you know, it's tough to predict what would happen because the council tends to be a less ideological organization than the legislature. And there's far fewer members. It really hinges on relationships and personality. And I think Waters was uniquely good at juggling that. So if he ultimately is not eligible to run for re-election, it's not clear to me who the heir apparent would be. I mean, that would be a conversation among the members of council. It's just not as cut and dry and clear as it would be in the state house, for example.
I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to bring up with respect to eligibility, city council, elections, and all of that.
Voters are going to find this confusing, and rightfully so, because it is confusing. And even people who follow this, I don't think today fully understand everything that is likely to result from this decision. But, I do think the courts will work quickly. I do think we'll have much more clarity here relatively soon. And, you know, if anyone who lives in that district and is voting, I mean, the important thing to remember is that, yes, this decision will affect this particular race, but it doesn't affect any of the other races. And so, I wouldn't want anyone to get the idea that somehow their ballot is going to be invalidated. That's not going to happen.
That was political science professor Colin Moore and HPR's Mark Liddell. The last day of the primary election is August 8th, and this Saturday is the deadline to request an absentee ballot. The other big political story this campaign season is the bribery indictments that triggered Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke to abandon her re-election campaign and take a leave of absence from her job. On the Longview, Neil Milner has some thoughts on context. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
We've been waiting for the shoe to drop, and it has now, but how should we be looking at this case?
Well, the shoe has barely dropped. I mean, this is the beginning of a story, and it took too long for this part of the shoe to drop, but where we are right now is that five people have been arraigned. One is the lobbyist, Toby Sodom, who is accused essentially of bribing, giving money to Sylvia Luke, former Representative Ryan Yamani, state transportation official, Floyd Fujigami, and then also charged was a Luke campaign official, Leo Asuncion, on the grounds that he, with Luke's understanding, hid some of the money that they got. And the money was really about this is the allegation. It was really about Toby Suadam, who is a lobbyist for the Kidney Foundation and the Kidney Foundation's COVID testing program, which was pretty much the testing program at one time and was making Toby Suadam a ton of money. So that's what the allegations are about. At this stage, there's a whole lot of legal weeds, but I thought one of the ways to understand what's likely to go on is to think of three stories here. The stories that the prosecutor is likely to tell, that is their strategy, but it really will be a lot like a story. The story that the defense is likely to tell, where the characters come out with a different shading, and a third story that is not going to get enough attention because in some ways it's outside the case. But that's a story, a general corruption and funds, money, and politics story. So the lobbyist who is in the Philippines somewhere and will have to be forced to come back legally promised Sylvia Luke $70,000 in campaign support. Luke, now again, this is the story, the allegation. Luke accepted at least two $5,000 contributions, and these contributions were connected to her going to the legislature to push for fund COVID testing. In other words, they see a quid pro quo. You got the money was for that, and she went ahead and did it. The defense story, the potential defense, is going to be very different. It's going to be that, one, there was no agreement. No agreement at all. A lot of this centers around supposedly a dinner at Morton Steakhouse where they worked out and they were recorded by a government informant who happened to be Ty Cullen, who was acting as an informant after he had served or was about to serve time for bribery. Okay, there was no agreement. That's the story. They were having dinner and they were talking about stuff. And campaign fundraising and lobbying occur together routinely. That is, that it routinely means, and it really means legally, that what was going on here is a discussion about the advantages of the COVID testing and why they should go ahead and do it. And he, at the same time, at that thing, offered, said, I'm going to give you a campaign contribution. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things often occur together.
Right.
That's an important one. It's an important one because the law tends to say, unless you can show there's a quid pro quo, unless you can show that the money was given A to do B, that it's okay. But the story the defense would tell is that it's nothing but a meeting of the minds. This is ordinary politics. This is what lobbyists do. Lobbyists try to convince people to do stuff. And it's within the law to, at the same time, support candidates that you're trying to influence. So that's essentially the situation. And remember that what people commonly think of as bribery, that story that con sense, in quotes, people tell, is that's bribery automatically. Money changed hands, it's automatically. That's not how the law works. The law has to show that there really is a relationship here, that Sylvia Luke did not simply take the money and then say, now I'm going to help out the other side. She may have taken the campaign money, but she didn't necessarily do it. She didn't go ahead and act accordingly just because she got the money. And that's an important distinction there. The other important factor is no one knows what happened about that $35,000. This whole investigation got re-stimulated thanks to pretty much Sybil Beach story finding out about a $35,000 bribe from an influential legislator, as the story went. Mm-hmm. It's never been clear. That doesn't show up in the indictment. It's never been clear if that's involved. But be that as it may, those are the two stories that are going to dominate. So one side says there is an agreement and bribery, and the other side says it was just normal politics. So the third story is it's pretty close to normal politics, whichever way it goes, that when you think about corruption is a broader term. It's not a legal term. So the situation is that you can do a lot of area exchange of money without violating the law, and that ordinary people might call bribery or corruption, but it may be perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal, for example, for people who do business with the government to give campaign contributions to legislators. And there has been a movement. Dan Foley's committee a few years ago essentially said there is a culture of corruption and two things have to be done to deal with the culture of corruption. One is to change that law to make it illegal for those contributions. And the other one has to do with a kind of a technicality that's related to that by saying that we should have public funding of elections. So my point is, you're going to get some interesting stuff from this trial about guilt and innocence, but it does not deal with this overall issue of money in politics, where you can have the Carpenters Union give enormous amount of money legally, and where you can have people taking money from folks doing business with government legally.
Yeah, it's a mess and something that needs to get sorted out.
Well, it's a variety of messes. And mm-hmm. I don't, you know, people, if you look at some of the reactions so far, well, one of the reactions is, you know, hang them high, basically. They're guilty, hang them mm-hmm. high, if you read comments. But another reaction is that this will begin to take care of it, that we can move from here into looking at other people who are taking bribes. Well, you can. I mean, if you want to, there's nothing wrong with investigating whether this has the tentacles or somewhere out there. But you have to also remember that part of the complicating issue here is how much of this kind of money is essentially changing hands legally. And in fact, part of that defense story is, hey, this is ordinary politics. The lobbyists gave us money, and that's okay. And we didn't just turn around, we being Sylvia, didn't just turn around and do what he said. There was no quid pro quo.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see how this all plays out. But thank you so much, Neil.
You're welcome. Take care.
We have been hearing from political analyst and HPR's longtime contributor, Neil Milner, with The Long View. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. In today's backyard quiz, is it a bird? Is it a plane? Well, a little bit of both. It's a drone. These flying machines have proven to be an asset to scientists in Hawaii. Aerial drone technology has been used to discover native plant species living in unreachable terrain. Back in 2024, we reported how scientists with the National Tropical Botanical Garden and Plant Extinction Prevention Program were using high-tech drones to survey the steep cliffs of Kauai. The dangerous near-vertical mountains create plant reservoirs, keeping rare species safe from predators. You might wonder, how do these drones work? Well, two pilots operate the flying machine and collect plant samples using a robotic metal arm. This arm is then carried through the mountain range, and scientists expertly navigated around sharp rocks to collect samples. This technology has helped scientists discover at least 11 inaccessible species on Kauai, five of which are critically endangered. Today, we want to know, what is the name of the robotic arm used to collect plant samples? Here's a hint. While this arm collects plants, it's actually named after an animal. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag. You'll also score a pack of the card game Kumulaau, courtesy of our friends at Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Smoke is rising higher, fire, fire, just around the corner, and I want you.
You know, we have been turning the political golf ball over and over in recent months as the loss of the Sony Open and the Century Golf Tournaments have rocked the economy. Today we hear from Ray Tsuchiyama, who penned an op-ed in the Star Advertiser recently about the need for a golf strategy. Tsuchiyama is with Guild Consulting and is a golfer who covers golf course issues for Cheney Brooks. He joined us in studio yesterday.
Golf is part of the economy. I think that's the first impact that we have to really decide on. And it may be as much as $1 billion, maybe $2 billion in direct spending and indirect spending for the entire state. There is all kinds of jobs associated with golf courses, not only in turf management, but culinary, accountants, general managers. This is an ecosystem, and there's more than 70 of these golf courses throughout Hawaii. And there's been a decline for the last 20 years in golf, and the sudden termination of two PGA golf tournaments for Hawaii sent out alarm bells that we are not stewarding this vital economic sector for Hawaii called golf.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's just the perception that they don't realize what all this free marketing has done for Hawaii over the many decades, and they have the bottom fall out, and it's just like, oh, what do we do now?
That's absolutely correct. When you look at what we pay HTA to promote the state in marketing dollars, we have free advertising worth tens of billions with the Sony Open every January for the past so many years. And that drives tourism, visitors to Hawaii. They would love to be in Hawaii when it's January in Michigan or New York.
Yes, and your idea that we are just failing at actually nurturing this, that really is an important force in our economy.
That's correct. And the state has promoted industries, high tech, renewable energy, healthcare, agriculture. There are many sectors of our economy that the state prioritizes, but we have never seen golf in the same way. And we have never really recognized golf or created a research and educational foundation to create a cadre, a cohort of very smart people who also have a handicap of 10.
Yes, because that's the requirement for actually getting these degrees, right?
That's correct. In Ohio State University, Florida Coastal College in Wisconsin and Nevada will admit students who want to be golf pros and managers of clubhouses, do financing, marketing. And also they teach strokes and driving and turf management. And you come into a program, a bachelor's level program in these universities. And in the states that really promote golf and have golf economies of nearly $4 billion in these states, like Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and Oregon. And so you're correct. 10 or below is the minimum requirement the PGA accredited.
Let's talk about numbers because, you know, I just got back from a trip from Guam and I was told that they had about a dozen golf courses and that four of them have shut down because they don't get the traffic from Japan, you know, where the Japanese visitors would come over for the weekend because it's, you know, just a few hours away from Guam. And so I worry about that. Like, you know, what about our golf course, our 70 golf courses across the state?
That's right. And data-wise, Florida State has 1,200 golf courses, and there are Midwestern states with 600, 800 golf courses. So the 70 are around, and we don't really have good data. And some golf courses have closed in the last 10 years, too. And we really don't have data on visitors who are golfers. There's not a check when you sign your agricultural form. Are you a golfer coming to Hawaii? And you're correct. Some of the luxury courses, Hualalai, make money. Wailea, Gold, Emerald, Kapalua are global destinations for golf. However, other courses, local courses that also depend on Waikiki traffic to go to, like Hawaii Kai or Ewa or, you know, out in the middle of the island, are hurting. And I think because not only of high costs maintaining these golf courses, but the Japanese and Asian visitors have declined during the last few years since COVID. You're absolutely right.
Well, so what are you suggesting? What do you think we need to do? Do we need a golf czar? You know, we've heard calls for a sports commission to have knowledgeable people about these various sports who have the finger on the pulse so that they can anticipate trends or, you know, and not we're not like caught like a chicken with its head cut off when something major happens.
Unfortunately, I think golf, because of the nature of the game, people approach it more as a lightweight sport, not as an economic driver for the state. And that's the first kind of mindset we have to get the state into. What will it take to get Hawaii to reach this goal? Maybe 2,000 in 3 years. I'm sorry, 2 billion in 2 years, or a 5 billion economy in 5 or 10 years. That's the kind of dashboard, the education. And also, I think we are seeing a decline in local golfers. Young people are not joining the game. When I, of course, when I'm at Alawai, most of the people are Social Security with me. But we have to get a younger sector, a demographic into golf and to think it seriously as a career, seriously as research, seriously as a business. And same thing like tourism. Why aren't there some GMs of major Waikiki hotels from Hawaii? Why can't golf courses throughout the world be populated by pros and GMs from Hawaii in a similar way? So there has to be an ecosystem, not only of promoting golf for Hawaii, the visitor industry, but promoting golf within the local people and a robust career program with professional degrees.
Yeah, I mean, we lack a strategy, you know, and you know, when I hearken back to my first time at the Sony Open, and I was there covering Michelle Wee, and how exciting that was, you know, to have this, you know, young golfer out there, you know, and the Ted Fujikawas and the Parker McLaughlins, right? And but they're getting on in age, and it's like, where are the other golfers who are going to create that buzz?
That's right. And with local, you know, great golfers, you have local interest in golfing, especially among young people. And with those local golfers becoming, you know, stars, you have the eyes of the world on Hawaii and golf and everybody wanting to come and play at the same courses that these top professionals play at.
You know, we're at this juncture, you know, we've got some fill-in tournaments, right? We've got the seniors for January, you know, there's talk of trying to think outside the box. What else could we do? What else can we create to get the television cameras on tournaments that we could showcase out here?
And that's what the goal of a Hawaii Golf Alliance or Council should be, and use the power of the state legislatures, the executive branch, when they go out, not only make calls to companies and organizations, but also to the golf organizations and try to promote it, promote Hawaii, and attract more attention to not only the luxury courses, but also the courses that local people play at throughout the state.
And so, you know, we're at a important juncture here. You know, the Hawaii Tourism Authority is about to name, you know, its executive, right? And now HTA is under DBED, the Department of, you know, Economic Development, Business and Tourism. But what's your hope for going forward?
Well, I hope that the governor and the state and all the counties really create an ecosystem. And based on first data, what's the data on golfers and visitors who golf and also local people who golf? What's their experiences? How can we make a better experience for golf in Hawaii? And also look at, you know, nitty-gritty expenses. Is it too expensive for local people? I mean, you have luxury courses in Maui and Hawaii Island that may have one day equal $1,000 if you throw in lunch and buying things at the pro shop and so forth for visitors. Is that an obstacle? Or again, looking at golf as an ecosystem, economy, but looking at the experience, how to make it a comfortable experience and one that really, one that is the highlight of your visit to Hawaii. And that's what we have to do and make golf a, again, a full destination. And again, places like Scotland also do a lot of promotion, history of golfing. There's a lot of things that you can do with UH and programs that link golfing to agriculture, to water conservation, to sustainability, renewable energy. These are all programs that could be tied together that we become the center, the mecca of golf R&D for the world.
Yeah, so how to become more resilient when it comes to golf tourism and, you know, making sure that, you know, droughts don't, you know, do us in.
Well, one of the issues, of course, is Kapalua with the golf course there under CEO Yanai that has been in the press a lot. And he is bringing up a topic. Water is there. It's just that the systems to bring water to golf courses and to agriculture are dilapidated, must be addressed. And he's coming out as a major CEO of Uniqlo from Japan and putting forth that question, is golf and golf courses and the golf economy important enough to get people to get together,
yes,
to resolve?
And improve the infrastructure and make sure that there are transmission systems for not just golfers, but for farmers, for residences, you know, for development. But yeah, we've got to, there are no easy answers, but we've got to make some tough decisions.
That's correct. And we're looking at the future. And I think, again, going back to the crucial question, is golf a priority for the economy and for our society? And for many, many decades, it was like it's a plaything. It's playful. It's a sport. But again, it's an ecosystem. And other states and countries are driving their whole economies through golf.
And we should learn from that. Thank you so much, Ray, for your thoughts on this issue.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Ray Tsuchiyama, who raises questions about whether Hawaii is doing enough to develop a golf strategy going forward.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
Hawaii Public Radio invites you to a special live from the Atherton Storytellers event, Stories from the Top. The Young Musicians Showcase has brightened our Saturday mornings on HPR2. Now hear stories from some of the musicians' journeys with Joshua Nakazawa and Taiga Benito. This free event is Thursday, August 6th at 6 p.m., with doors opening at 5:30. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
On the next Fresh Air, over 40,000 people a year die from gunshots in the U.S. It's the leading cause of death for children. Recent Supreme Court decisions demonstrate we're getting fewer laws regulating guns, not more. We'll speak with New York Times reporter Mike McIntyre about why this is. His new book is called Ricochet: Guns, Greed, and the American Way of Violence. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy's Empower program, helping small businesses with energy solutions. Learn more about this grant program at hawaiienergy.com/empower.
And now now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we reminded you of an effort in the islands to use high-tech drones to reach cliffs and other secluded places where critically endangered plants can be found. The drone features a robotic arm that can be maneuvered to grab and preserve plant samples. We asked you to tell us the name for this electronic arm, which is named after a creature known for lifting almost its entire body off the ground and lunging forward to swallow its prey into its mouth. Like its namesake, this robotic arm is lifted into position by a drone before scientists extend it forward to scoop the plant right into the collection basket. And the name of this robotic arm used by scientists, the Mamba, think snake. And unlike its animal counterpart, this machine is using its bite power for good. The tool will help protect the hundreds of plant species endemic to Kauai, 90% of which are critically endangered. Congrats to Greg from Kauai, who says he volunteers with the National Tropical Botanical Garden, and he has gotten to see the drones in action firsthand. But that is our quiz today. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And if you're curious to learn more about the Mamba at work, look for our 2024 interview with scientist Ben Nyberg. Search for it on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Governor Josh Green signed a bill into law last month aiming to keep our young people safe on our roads. Fatalities on Oahu's roads hit an 18-year high of 129 deaths. The new law tackles one dangerous practice. It raises the minimum legal age to ride in a truck bed from 12 to 16. Hawaii now joins the 29 other states in the nation that also have restrictions on riding in the bed of a pickup truck. Violators will pick up a minimum $25 fine for each infraction. HPR's Kevin Allen and Addis Balai went down to Sandy Beach to talk to people about the new law. Alan from Waimanalo and Jesse from Eva are all for the increased age restriction.
It's a good law to have because I feel like there's a lot of irresponsible drivers out there that like put their kids or like their brothers, their younger brothers out in the back. And like a lot of stuff could happen because my uncle, he had an accident and he was in the back of a truck. And like he can't remember a lot of things now. He has short-term memory loss. So I feel like it's a good law to have. Like, I don't know. I just feel like there's irresponsible drivers out there.
You think there could be like a little bit more regulation kind of put into place to make sure?
Yeah, there's just a lot of things could happen. You know, you never know like what could happen next.
Yeah.
Like I could get into a car crash after, like you never know. So it's better to be safe than sorry.
Can you talk to me a little bit about, I guess, your personal, you know, history with the trucks?
I mean, my papa, he would always be like, oh yeah, hop in the back. But my mom would never let me. She was like, no, something's gonna happen. So I've only like a little bit of experience with it, but it was only really short distances that I would ride in the back. But like, I'm not gonna lie, it was fun riding in the back because like you feel good out there, but you know, it's just a lot of stuff could happen.
The risk is not worth the reward.
Yeah, the risk is not worth the reward.
I personally don't condone for people to be in the back of the truck, period. I mean, the amount of accidents that's going on right now. And you could be the perfect driver, but the guy behind you might be texting, not paying attention, looking at his whatever in the car, eating, and then, you know. I was that dummy in the back of the truck, not just sitting back there, but on the side of it, on the rail.
Oh,
so,
yeah, yeah.
And that's dangerous, you know. And you never know when you hit a pothole and you're going hoolie right over. So trying to lead on better example right now. And by that, I mean, there's a reason there's a lid on the back of my truck now.
Absolutely.
So kids don't get any funny ideas.
And Kevin from Hawaii Kai thinks that speed, more so than age, should be a limiting factor. And Tiana from the North Shore and Chevelle from Waimanalo feel fine sitting in the back of a truck as long as they trust their driver.
Within your own neighborhood, completely appropriate to ride in the back of the truck. If you're 6, 8 years old, if there's a parent in the back of it, I don't think there should be some restrictions, no doubt. I don't think anybody should be riding in the back of a truck on a freeway.
So you're saying like speed, like, you know, if you're going a certain limit, it's okay. If you're going like above a certain limit.
If you're in a speed zone of 25, 35 miles per hour, I think it's completely appropriate. Again, if you're going to go on the freeway, I don't think it's appropriate for anybody.
And you had kind of just talked a little bit. You said you grew up, you know, riding the back of the truck. I mean, yeah, just if you could describe to me kind of what that meant to you, like just getting around or just cruising with people. Why was that kind of such an important thing for you, I guess?
Oh, it's just the freedom of not being belted in, and the fact that the wind going through your hair, that all your senses are alive.
Honestly, I think it really depends. I feel like younger kids, like younger, definitely shouldn't be allowed to ride in the back of the truck. God forbid they like sit up, stand up, or like reckless drivers. Like, I feel like there's just a lot of circumstances in which like the driver shouldn't be trusted to have younger aged kids. I think 16 is probably around a good age that kids should be riding in the back of the truck. And any younger might be a little bit dangerous and kids might not know better, or might be a little bit more likely to like mess around, play around kind of thing. Yeah.
I agree with you, but I also think like 16 is a little too much. I feel like once you're at the age of 13, you kind of know common sense, and you know it's better to sit down than to stand up in a truck. But also, I think they also put the law up for the drivers, because there's a lot of reckless drivers up here and there's a lot of accidents that be happening. So I think a lot of people will agree that this rule is good, and a lot will disagree. I feel like it's kind of a common thing coming from and growing up from Hawaii. You kind of, it's local, you ride in the back of a truck. And I personally didn't have any bad experience. I've been riding in the back of a truck since like the ripe age of like 8 or 9. So yeah, I would say it's pretty chill.
I think depending on like, I would do it with my parents. I don't know if I'd trust a lot of my friends. Like, I don't know, a lot of my friends aren't the best drivers. Like, I don't know if I'd trust like 16-year-old me or younger than 16-year-old me in the back of like one of their trucks. But maybe like with my parents, I think it's very situational.
And for Clifton, who's from Haleiwa but now lives in Reno, riding in trucks is just a way of life.
I mean, it's no big deal. Growing up like that, everybody rode in the back, you know. I remember riding in the hatchback with this up, riding in the back, so. But I don't think it's a problem. I mean, 12 to 16 is fine. I mean, as long as your baby's not running around the back. You know,
kind of growing up in Haleiwa, did you ride in the back of, I'm sure you rode in the back of a lot of vehicles.
All the time.
How's he going to get around?
Yeah. I mean, how many people can fit in the back compared to inside here?
Do you think would you say it's like a good thing that now you got to be a little bit older to ride in the back of a truck, or?
No, as long as everybody's safe, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, 12, 16, that's fine.
And that was all thanks to Kevin Allen and Addis Balai reporting from the sandy streets of Sandy Beach parking lot. You can learn more about the new law on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And let us know what you think. Leave a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. That's it for us. We're out of time. But tomorrow, we consider the future of the Peace Corps as it marks its 65th anniversary. Got feedback for us? Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.